Hello, everybody. It's Jughead, and thank you for listening to this podcast. I really do appreciate it. I would like to start right off the bat by thanking two new patrons. I've had pretty good luck the last couple of weeks with new patrons, and I would like you to join. Just go to www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com. You can press a button that says Patreon, and it will whiz you to a new location where you can join at the $2, $5, and $10 tiers. The $2 tier is a nice gesture towards me and the program, so thank you. You also get one unedited video brought to you every month. If you join at the $5 and $10 tiers, you get every single episode released to you advanced in the unedited video form. Plus, you get to have conversations with me and question and answer sessions. And for the $10 tier, you get shit in the mail for me, signed. Could be CDs, could be books, or maybe it's even literally shit. I doubt it, but it's possible. If I lose my mind anymore. And speaking of which, Ian Nelson. Ian Nelson joined at the $10 tier, but also did this cool thing where you could pay for a year in advance, which is great for me, and also just gets it out of the way, and you also get a discount. So he came in at the $10 tier and paid for a year in advance. Plus, I also have Jason Michael Stilley, who also came at the $10 tier. So thank you to both of you. If you can't pay money to me, I completely understand that. I can hardly even pay money to me, and I'm me. What you can do is share the podcast, share it with friends, animals, couches, the letter F, training schools, the color red, fuchsia, robots, whoever you think might enjoy the show. And what you can also do is go to one of your places of getting podcasts and give a review, or a star, or a bunch of stars, preferably 4 or 5, if 5 is the most. And also it is good to write a review with words and commas and expressions and umlauts in any language you prefer. I'm really super excited about this episode, and I would like to throw out a thanks to Jenna Alley and also John Ross Bowie for helping me get Fred Armisen onto the show. I would also like to say, since I am my own PR person, it took a while to get Fred, because he's a busy man, you know. And eventually he said, how about tomorrow? And I was like, not much study time. So I'm going into this one with quite a lot of last minute studying. And I got a little bit nervous and talked a lot. But I think we got along really well. And I think there's some cool information in here. And I really picked his brain about drumming. And I think he enjoyed that. So let's get this thing going. Here we go. Right now, you're listening to the song Hitmen Will Suffocate the City by Trenchmouth, released in 2012 on the album Volumes, Amplifiers, Equalizers. Hey everybody, thank you for visiting Jughead's Basement. This is the subcategory Lo-Fi Interviews with Hi-Fi Guests, episode number 132 with Fred Armisen of Trenchmouth, Portlandia, Saturday Night Live. He's a drummer and comedian, and Fred talks to us about John Ross Bowie, cafes in Chicago, his mohawk being hassled, trophy for Mike Watt, a real thing we'd like to do, punk uniforms and just being punk, Kinko's appreciation, his Netflix special Stand Up for Drummers, and also much, much fucking Fred Armisen more. Every day. Ah, Fred.
Good. How you doing?
Good. How are you, sir?
Good. Excellent.
Wow. We made that happen quick.
Yeah.
So thank you for doing this, Fred.
Oh, my pleasure. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. So I'm in my basement. That's why it's Jughead's basement. I'm surrounded by notes, which I compiled from last night till today.
Wow. Thanks for doing that.
Oh, no problem. And just so you know, I like to have these be more of a dialogue, even though I have notes around and questions I could ask. I feel like we're near the same age. We spend a lot of time in the same area. We'll probably be able to fling a lot of it.
Yeah.
Very excited to finally get you on here. I know John Ross Bowie was trying to help us make this happen. He strong-armed you a little bit, I think.
No, I mean, he's such a sort of cheerleader for the scene, you know. Anything that he says is a good idea, I'm all for it.
Yeah, he actually wrote yesterday to me. He goes, I said, well, I want to study Fred before I meet him, so I'm a little nervous. And he said, well, multi-instrumentalist, trench mouth were weird, older than the average SNL recruit, made the cover of Punk Planet one time. So my goal is to not touch on those. So
okay.
Hello, this is John Jughead of The Future Past, and if you're new to this podcast, you'll realize that I often step in here to give facts in the moment to clarify things that you might have heard on this interview. So right here, I will say that John Ross Bowie, along with Jen Alley, helped me get Fred Armisen on the show. And his episode, John Ross Bowie, is episode 125. Back to me and Fred. I heard an interview with you that you worked at Urbis Orbis.
Yeah.
Cafe. Wow. That's what years was that? Like around 92, 93, 90, 80s?
No, it feels like it might have been more like 94, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
It's like somewhere in there. But 94, 95, maybe 94, but it was, one of the earliest memories of like what a coffee shop, you know, like sort of, you know, the coffee shop and that's those independently run. In the, you know, cool part of town. There were a couple in Minneapolis that I knew, but that was like the Chicago one, the Wicker Park one. I mean, of course, there were others, and of course more opened up, but that was just sort of like my first experience of like, wow, this is like one of those, you know, independent cool coffee shops.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was fun. It was a huge space. I remember.
Yeah. I thought I was familiar with it, but I actually realized I used to go for carrot cake in a cafe right there. And it was actually Earwax, which was like down the
nearby.
Street on Damon. Yeah.
Yeah. That was nearby.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember that Urbis Orbis was also across the street from where this band Math used to rehearse and sometimes have shows. It was like an art space, but they also lived there. And Math was like, because you couldn't really categorize them, they're very much a sort of art band. But I don't know if that's really a category, you know, it's like
bands. Avant-garde, if you want to say.
You know, they weren't even avant-garde. It was like this other picture, like music that sounds like it could be from the 20s, mm-hmm. or from the 90s, like a mix of like almost vaudeville, you know, like organ,
Kurt Vile type stuff.
Yeah, simple percussion, but it's like a type of music that you don't see documented very much as part of a scene, because I think lots of cities had that. They're sort of, you know, that sort of artistic kind of band, and because it doesn't qualify in some ways as punk, they sort of always sort of, you know, move it aside as something else. But I do feel like the band Math was an important part of that scene.
I think they were on a compilation that I knew of, like a alternative rock compilation.
Yes.
There. Yeah. Just to put a little information about me, I during that time, I was also in the Neo Futurists, you know, Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind. Did you ever get to see
that
show?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I did that for 20 years. So I also had more of an
artsy crossover in music too. So I was able to walk those balances of the pop punk scene and the more artsy bands that came out of that area.
Hey, look, it's Future John again. I did some studying and it was hard to find some stuff on this band Math, but there is an article on a WFMU radio station program and also a compilation, which is supposedly one of the only documentations of the band Math. And Trenchmouth is on this compilation too. So you can look up CIA via UFO to Mercury. That's the name of the compilation. Came out in 2006. I also couldn't remember the name of the band, but I wanted to mention to Fred this band called Maestro Subgum and the Hole, which was a band started by Bo O'Reilly, a pretty well-known figure in the Chicago theater scene, and he worked with Curious Theater Branch. I'll have some of this on the webpage at www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com. Just realized the band that Fred is just about to bring up is also on that compilation.
There was one band who was later than this. Their name might be more towards 96 or something, called the Flying Luttenbachers. And they were like sped up, almost jazz. They were like really, really great. Weasel Walter, it's his band. So that kind of like was part of that scene, but like a sped up version of it.
I looked up Urbazorbas because I couldn't quite remember where it was. And that was in the Flatiron building, which had a recording studio that we recorded in like 93 EP called You Broke My Fucking Heart. But that's when I was like, I go, Urbazorbas, why is that so familiar?
Yeah. That was like, to me, it felt very central. You know, it just felt very like, that was a, you know, I'm just, I guess Earwax was that way too, but there just weren't many as there are now. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in the suburbs and I worked at a Gloria Jean's Coffee Beans. And when that was around, there wasn't even cafes really per se, you know, Paris, of course, but like Chicago didn't have that type of thing. So when I moved into the city, it was the beginning of, like you're saying, it was the beginning of that excitement of hanging out in cafes.
Yeah.
It sort of hit Chicago.
Yeah.
Were you living in Wicker Park then?
Yep.
Ah, did you gravitate there when you moved from New York?
I loved it. Yeah. I loved it. Wicker Park was great. I was there long enough that like when we first were in Wicker Park, I remember when I first moved to Chicago, we moved to like Wrigleyville and then like up and then also like up north a little bit, you know, like that's all we could afford. But then like, as we figured out like the place to be was Wicker Park, I remember at first, there was nothing there. There were like no restaurants or anything. Mm-hmm. And there was a club we played called Club Dreamers.
Oh, hold on.
Club Dreamers.
I wrote it down. It burned down. Yeah, we used to play there too. So I went on Facebook like 2 minutes before calling you. And I said, what was the name of that place? And so
Club Dreamers.
Yeah. So go ahead.
It was great. That was in Wicker Park. And I remember, you know, like we'd play there and there was just no place to eat. Like there was like, we had to go back to somewhere else, but we saw some great bands there. I mean, I liked going to shows there and we had some fun shows.
Yeah. I remember when we were in the suburbs, when we first played there and our friend Amy, who drove us, she was the one with the car. So she would, you know, drive us with our equipment there and her car was stolen at that show. That's why I always remembered Club Dreamers, because that Wicker Park was pretty scary back then.
It was scary. And even in the 90s as it, because when we played Club Dreamers, that must have been 89 or something.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. 88 I played there. So yeah.
But even in the 90s, it was never quite 100% safe. Like it was still, there was, you know, it was like still a city. I mean, you know, it's a city and you can get your car stolen or whatever. I've been mugged. I was mugged in Chicago. And so that's all. I mean, it was a while until it became like a really populated place. And
we actually moved, when I moved into the city, we moved into an area that was even farther behind Wicker Park and becoming like an art area, which was Logan Square. And that was, that was pretty dangerous back then. I was there around 90. I think we moved into Logan Square and I for years I didn't talk about it, but I was actually caught in a shootout between two gangs there.
Yeah.
And it was, I couldn't talk about it for years because I didn't want to glorify the incident at all, but I was walking home from the station, like the Belmont Blue Line station.
Yeah.
And some guy was running towards me. So I just like instinctively just turned around and started walking. And then he got shot like right when I was standing right there.
Yeah, man.
And I just kept walking. That's the kind of thing you did then. You learned to just keep walking, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting, like, you bringing up that, like, you don't want to talk about it because it's, like, not glorifying it. Because I agree with you. Like, I'm also, like, when we tell stories in, you know, in terms of, like, music stuff, to talk about gang fights or, you know, getting mugged or getting shot, it does lean into romanticizing it a little bit.
Exactly.
So that I know exactly what you mean. You're like, you don't want to be like, yeah, what a crazy place. There was gunfire everywhere.
Yeah. I have a difficult relationship with that glorifying. Cause I think even like movies like Trainspotting, even though it's disgusting to watch, there's still a bit that's like glorifying and romanticizing.
Definitely.
That. Yeah.
Definitely.
So I have like, a weird relationship with those type of movies.
Same here.
The only one that I think that did it well was, what's his name? Dream. I can't remember the name of it. It had the three different stories of heroin. It was the old woman that was addicted to TV shows. Oh, what's the name of that movie?
Oh, I think I know what you mean.
And then the woman who loses her arm, she used to dance on tables. Yeah. I can't remember the name, but it was Dream something. But that was the only movie to me that gave me that horrible feeling you're supposed to feel when you're learning about like drug abuse.
The movie I am referring to is Requiem for a Dream by Darren Aronofsky.
I felt about that way about talking about
G.G. Allen.
For years, I couldn't talk about him because I was like, I learned from having a singer that's a shock value singer that the more you do that, that's what popularizes you. And then they don't really hear the music anymore. They don't, you know, they get off on that. And for years, I wouldn't talk about G.G. Allen because of that, for that very reason. Andy tried to mace us when we came to a show, but I hold a little bit of grudge towards it.
That'll cause a grudge.
I think that's fascinating that you came for Wicker Park. I know you you started comedy a little bit after. You were probably doing comedy since you were little, but did you have the Second City approach at all, or did you find a different venue?
No.
I was surprised by that when I started studying you, that wasn't...
Yeah, it all came from music. Like for some reason that's
wow.
Yeah. That's where, I don't know. It went from there and just, you know, little opportunities and doorways turned into other ones. And before I knew it, I was doing comedy, but I didn't go the stand up comedy route. I didn't do.
Yeah. I wondered about that too. Cause since I watched your drummer special, which was a lot of fun. I watched it with my girlfriend's in from Japan. Forever to try to get her here. Now we're trying to get me there, but the border's still closed. And just
so
people know, Abe just got shot and killed.
How wild is that?
Yeah. We sat crying a little bit this morning. So,
because
Japan, a shooting in Japan, like,
and
this guy that got
us. Mysterious, and someone who I feel like Abe is like recent. It's not like someone from the 80s who, you know, I'm like, that is a recent, you know, a current politician. It is wild. I can't believe that happened. Yeah.
What's bizarre is just that day when we found out yesterday, we're having trouble trying to be together because we're not letting Americans into Japan right now. And she has to leave here next week. So I'm like, well, all you have to do is, you know, talk to Abe. You know, I'm sure he can get his people in. You know?
Yeah.
You know, money talks. Money talks, Nanako.
No, too late.
Now it's too late to talk to him.
But, yeah.
But that was a sidetrack. I thought you might be interested in the Japan connection because I know you were, when you were looking into your past history, you thought you were probably part Japanese and it turned out Korean instead.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, pretty wild.
But, do you consider, I mean, it's a weird thing to say, but you've been in some very American places, but it seems like you've such European and Eastern influences in your way of being too. Does that make sense to you at all? Like, do you feel like you are other than American in some ways?
Definitely. I mean, my parents are immigrants.
Yeah.
And it's something that's like has always been a big part of my life. But that said, you know, that's what America is about anyway. So, in that sense, it feels very American.
Yeah. You know? The way it should be seen. And we're losing a little bit of perspective on that.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think when I was a kid, I didn't appreciate it as much. But now as an adult, I embrace the fact that, you know, there's all these cool places that my family came from.
Yeah. I don't know if you know Mike Park from Asian Man Records, but I had him on the show, and I didn't know how active like discrimination against Japanese or Korean people was these days. Like, and he shocked me with like things that people would yell at him while he was driving, or, and I know you have some, your structures are kind of, they look influenced otherly than or European. Yeah. Did you deal with that shit at all?
No. And I grew up in a sort of a very sort of Italian American town, a suburb in New York.
Yeah.
And my dad looks Asian, you know, he looks Asian, and we're of Latin American descent. And we really, I gotta say, no one hassled my dad. No one hassled me. I look very different. Not very different. I look kind of different, but no, I think the most thing that I ever got hassled for was having a mohawk. That's the only time where people would like shout things at me or throw things at me. No, it turned out to be, we had a very, like, we grew up in a really good neighborhood and a neighborhood that really embraced us.
That reminds me of a little short story of, I always talked about myself being a Puritan in the punk scene, like the one who, I had long hair when everyone else was doing mohawks. And my mom even said to me, John, you only have long hair because you're in a band. I go, Mom, I'm the only one with long hair in my scene. But I remember I was walking with an old girlfriend who had a child, and the kids saw these couple with punk haircuts, and they were like, what is your kid staring at? And I was like, well, you kind of do that to stand out. I mean, I think it's okay that a kid is staring at your cool mohawks. Yeah. I always thought that was kind of like an irony of that.
I mean, I think it's something that like some punks kind of liked. Some punks liked kind of saying, why is everyone staring at me? It's just like, clearly that's, you know, what the desire is, but that's just a part of being a punk, I think.
Yeah. Did you have a mohawk before you were in a band?
No, it was after. Yeah. I was in a hardcore band called the KGB.
You know, it's also a band from Germany that I did their show in the 80s with Zero Boys and Operation Ivy.
Oh, nice. Wow. Jeez.
Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It was way back.
But I heard that you were in a band called KGB, and there was a few of them all over the world.
I'm sure. Yeah. And we were just pretty much a high school band anyway.
I think
whatever, six shows or something. But like, but my mohawk wasn't like a hardcore mohawk. I wasn't like that. That's not what I was emulating. For me, it was very specifically Bow Wow Wow. Like, I was so into Bow Wow Wow, and I was just I really wanted it to look like Matthew Ashman.
Yeah, that's right. You're an 80s child too. You go. I had that crossover where I grew up with 70s brothers and sisters that were a little older than me, but I inherited a lot of that too, but I'm such an 80s child.
Yeah. But that's cool that you had long hair. Like, I think, like, you don't need me to tell you this, but like, you know, the idea that like, some punks had long hair is like, that's makes so much sense to me. Like, I loved how Dinosaur Jr. looked and Henry Rollins, and like, that's how it's really how it's supposed to be. I even felt like, I know they had short hair, but like the Minutemen and Husker Du looked like, you know, I feel like that's the look of what it's not just like the uniform that a punk is supposed to have. Like, those bands really were like, that's should be the real deal.
You know, and you just mentioned Minutemen, and Mike Watt is probably the most punk person I've ever met just by nature. Like, he doesn't even have to think or talk punk. And he's like, that documentary of, what is it called? Econo? Is it
We Jam Econo.
We Jam Econo. Wow. Yeah. I got to interview him right after that. And we cried together over Boone. I mean, talk about two people that got so close that one of them passing away. You just never get over that. And there's no getting over something like that.
Of course not. Of course not. But agreed about Mike Watt. I mean, he's, I just feel like I wish there was a system where we could just give him like, a medal or something, you know, because he's just done so much and he's like been so important to so many people. I'm just like, can't we just make a trophy? Can't we just make a one-time trophy that we just make just for him to be like, hey, you meant a lot to, or you mean a lot to a lot of us.
I'm going to write that down, Fred, because I think you and I could probably arrange a trophy for Mike.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other story I want to say is I was thinking of like Oregon and that area and Seattle. I drove in the 90s. My sister did this stupid audition for Soundgarden where she was supposed to, you know, David Letterman was doing those stupid human tricks at the time. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
And Soundgarden did a contest where you could win a dinner with Soundgarden if you do this stupid trick. And my sister was kind of like a rebellious kid then, and she just didn't know what to do. So she stood on stage, drank some flammable alcohol and spit fire like Gene Simmons. And she got it. She won. So she won dinner with them.
Wow.
And they loved her so much, like Chris Cornell, that they actually invited her to Seattle to work for them. And she knew Nirvana and all those. She's like a really likable person.
You might notice that I was nervous and I did a lot of talking during this interview, but it shallows out a little bit later. But what I did want to say here is that my sister clarified a little bit. The contest was actually sponsored by WCKG. Scott Loftus was the DJ at the time, who was the brother to my friend Tom Loftus, who worked for the Daily Herald. They offered up stupid human tricks. All the rest is true. The other part she corrected me on is that she didn't really know Nirvana, but she did tell me some stories about them that she heard from other sources. She worked mostly for Screaming Trees, Alice in Chains, Pearl Jam, and her favorite, Soundgarden.
Yeah, but I drove her all the way out there, so that's connection with Seattle. And then I guess what I'm getting at, this is like a personal thing, Fred. Yeah. My sister is one of the most influential people to me, amazing with people. Like Chris Cornell loved her, like, and when he died she was devastated. But if you could just say hello to Gene right now.
Hello, Gene. You really made Jughead's life much much more exciting and better, and he looks up to you and he's proud of you.
Thank you very much, Fred. Have you ever done I often talk, it actually appeared in my book, because I drove her all the way there and then dropped her off and drove all the way back. So I drove like 50 hours there and 50 hours back. But to me, that was not a lot, because with touring, that was kind of like your thing you did. You just got good at driving around a lot. Are you much of a driver yourself?
Yeah, I love driving. And when Trench Mouth went on tour, I drove as much as possible. I love driving, and I still do. And I love driving the van. But it's funny, like running an errand like that, you know, the one you described, I think that's just something we all did. Like, we just liked these like errands that took a long time. Like, you dropping her off is like, that makes so much sense to me. I'm like, oh yeah, I would have done the same. I know that. You know, driving someone for, I have a friend actually who I drove to her 10-year high school reunion, and she, it was in Detroit, just a friend of mine from Chicago to Detroit, and I didn't even go to the reunion. It was just like a ride. But you just did stuff like that. Like, oh, you need a ride to Detroit? Fine. You know, give me the directions and then you do it. Not a thought. It's just nothing.
There's a famous one in the Lookout Records world where, you know, Crim Shrine, you're familiar with?
Yeah.
But they, their band imploded in Florida, and they called me and Ben up at my house in Mount Prospect. Yeah. And, they needed someone to drive and pick them up. So we just hopped in my friend's Trans Am and drove all the way to Florida and brought them back to my house for a week. It's kind of like a famous story, because then their new bass player drove up from California to Chicago in a little teeny, I don't even know what's like a Volkswagen or something. And these are tall guys.
It actually was a Pinto.
And all four of them got into this teeny Volkswagen and duct taped their equipment to the outside. So as they drove, I was at the end of my driveway watching them drive off for the rest of their Crim Shrine, the only tour they ever did. And it was like, the bottom of the car was hitting the ground, but it wasn't even like a second thought at that time. It was years later when I thought about it. But back then I was like, this is what we do.
Perfectly fine.
What do you have any of your harrowing tour stories? That do you have any that you like to tell people?
Let me try to think of one that I don't tell people, just because, like, if I start, you know, going like, this happened on tour, I could feel myself just sort of going through the motions.
The motions, yeah. And thank you for that, because I try not to go through motions on this.
Yeah. The one thing that comes to mind, there's two. One is that our first tour, we didn't know how to rent a van, but a friend of ours did, and he sort of rented us a van. And we just pictured this you know, van, like a cargo van, but he showed up with a like a minivan. And there were so many of us. But it's not his fault. It's just that's, you know, we're young. We don't know what we're doing. And we put, last minute, we just were like, okay, what are we going to do about this problem? Our equipment does not fit. And so we put all the equipment on top and we used a tarp. We sort of tied a tarp, you know, and like, you know, when someone's good at tying up tarp down. So nothing disastrous happened. Like the equipment never fell, none of that stuff. We made our shows, we did it. But there was just no like logic put to like, do we need this much equipment? It's like, you know, drum cases and stuff like that. No part of our brain in our early 20s was like, why don't we not have drum cases? Why don't we find a smaller amp? Why don't we ask to borrow a kick drum? None of that. Like all we think is like our equipment. And then we throw all this equipment on top and it's just this added weight. And so that's my first memory of like a mistake. Also like on the drum cases, we'd spray paint stencil the name of the band, you know, as if anyone's going to mistake it, you know, for their own kick drum. Like, no, it'll be fine if it doesn't say anything on it.
Yeah.
It's like, it's sort of like just mimicking bigger bands, you know, like you need to put your name on there. No, you do not.
We were playing in New York State, one of the smaller cities there. And we accidentally, maybe have packed one of the drummer's instruments or something. And we knew we had it. That's what it was. And we stayed at his house that night. And we even said, we have some extra stuff, but we don't know whose it is. And they were all drunk and they're like, oh, we don't know. So on the road, we actually get a call from them, you know, because what you did was you'd call your voicemail back home because you didn't have cell phones. And he got a lawyer to sue us for stealing his equipment. It's like, what? It's like one cymbal stand. And we didn't, you know, we even asked him about it. It's just a story I always remember about how ridiculous people could get sometimes about that.
And also just how like, I mean, maybe it's in the days when you just had $0.
Exactly. Yeah.
Where like equipment was so valuable. It was just, you know, it's just like the only thing you could afford and you finally had it. I just also remember cymbal stands in general. Like if I needed a new one, I just had to wait. I wasn't like, I'm going to run down and get a cymbal stand. I don't have $79. I just don't have it. And I'm going to use my old cymbal stand because this is all I have.
I got a Westone guitar when I was young and it was like $100 guitar. And it was at a record store that I got it. And I used that throughout most of the Screeching Weasel records. It was by the time I had pen caps and because I lost the bridge. So I used Bic pen caps for that. Yeah. And I actually fell at a show one time in Texas and the jack broke. So I actually wired my like 20-foot cord into my guitar and didn't use a case anymore. I just wrapped it around the guitar.
That's exactly what I mean. Like this thinking that's like not, it's not real troubleshooting. It's not like really thinking things through and getting like, get this repaired. No, just like tape it down.
Yeah. Well, the thing is too, you're just, you know, you're driving because it's hard to book shows back then too. Once again, you're not like going in an order. You're not well known enough to like book a tour in order. So you're going from this side of Texas to that side of Texas and back again. So you're driving and playing. You don't even have time. Like we didn't even have time to go to stores and stuff. I tried to make my strings last, you know, they'd be all dirty and filthy by the time I got done with the tour.
Yeah. And anything was acceptable. When you talk about those distances, like I remember any show was fine. Like, what? It's at 4 p.m. At some parking lot and, you know, it's not really a show, but they're going to make it a show. And it's actually, you know.
That brings back memories.
So many things that you're like, you accept as a show where like, where is the wherewithal? They'd be like, maybe that's too far to drive for that. But oh my God, we would take, you know, fifth band on a bill and just show up and play whenever.
Yeah, we actually, Weasel, one of the reasons I thought we did well, but it made it hard, is that we had these unbelievable rules for a band that were just starting out, but we couldn't play after 10 and we had to headline. So we played a lot of shows in front of like two people.
Yeah.
But we never actually went through that. And that's why people are like, what famous bands did you guys meet? And I was like, well, we never did because we always play these like teeny shows. We are friends with bands that became famous, you know, like Greenwood, yeah, Operation Ivy, Rancid, all that. But
yeah,
I never played with like famous bands because we had this weird rule, but I'm pretty proud of it. It was really difficult though.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
We play in Detroit in front of like three people, you know.
Yeah.
Even New York, we played down the street from CBGB's. Yeah, Sonic Youth was playing there and we were playing down the street in this basement. I don't know if you know Jim Testa from Jersey Beat, but it was him and two actually Japanese couple that accidentally ended up at the show.
I've had a million of those shows. A million of the shows of like, guess who's playing down the street? Guess who's playing tonight?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm just like, that. It almost feels like that was the norm. Was always like, you know, guess who's playing tonight? Or guess who just played yesterday? Which also counts as like, no one's coming tonight.
We had that with a whole tour. Danzig was one day ahead of us at every venue we went to. And everyone was like, I would have been there, but you know, I blew all my money at the Danzig.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
All right, on to the next city. Yeah.
I'm glad I could relate to this stuff with you. I haven't been able to do this in a while with the.
Oh, good. It's such a funny memory. It's like, even though it was, you know, it could be difficult, at the same time, I remember us laughing a lot as a band. So that stuff was all a drag, but God, we had a great time. There wasn't a gamble. It wasn't like, hey, we invested all this money. We didn't have any money anyway.
No.
So it was just like kind of a, you know, an excuse for friends to do stuff together.
Yeah, I think that was kind of, I don't know. I like to say unique, but I don't know. But I've talked to a lot of people and that was fairly unique for our decade of punk rock, that it was this community, because after, you know, once Green Day broke, I started noticing on the road that you would have bands with, you know, vans that their parents bought them and they were expecting that their next record was going to be on a major.
Yeah.
But for us, you're right. It was like, we were just doing what we could to get out of our own town.
Yeah. And Chicago is a great place for that because the surrounding areas are like a real adventure. You know, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Indiana, downstate Illinois. It's pretty exciting to like, you know, Iowa. That's like, those are really cool places to play. I'm really glad that Trench Mouth had that as its surrounding areas. I really romanticized those drives, those flat drives. You know, there's like no hills. So it was awesome to get out and not very far. You go to Michigan. We went to Kalamazoo a bunch, Indianapolis.
Our recording guy was in, Master Giorgini was in, from the studio called Sonic Iguana was in Lafayette. So it's a small town. I mean, it's a college town, but you know, Toxic Reasons were from there. Like I said, Zero Boys. Yeah. The whole Midwest was pretty, powerful, I think, in those days.
And friendly as places to go. Like, go get something to eat. It just felt fun. The drives felt fun. But going back to what you were saying before, I don't know who's going to have the energy to do this, but someone has to write a book about the role Kinko's played on American punk rock. Kinko's really deserves royalties for how much it just solidified punk rock across the country.
Flyers, zines at the time, you know, zines where everyone was doing zines, but that's how you found out about everything. There was no internet. So,
and flyers, the flyer situation, like every city had these flyers. I mean, you know, with the amount of the time we spent at Kinko's, it was just like, it's almost like band practice. Like there's band practice and there's Kinko's.
Yeah. We would go to the one, our drummer worked at the one on Clark by Belmont. It's gone now.
I know it. I really spent a lot of time there.
Yeah, yeah. It was weird. It was because we weren't really much drinkers, and even we were probably before 21. So it really was like a place you went to hang out too. It's open 24 hours, and you were night people because you're in a band. So
yeah.
Yeah, one of the keys was to get someone in your band to work at Kinko's. That was like, that was the loftiest goal.
Yeah, that's the goal for sure.
One of the things that I have is a structured question, and because the limited studying I did, I really dug that drummer's special that I watched on Netflix, and that was made for Netflix, right? Was it released as an album too?
The show was called Stand Up for Drummers, and it was released by Netflix on record in 2018.
Was there a difference to you to perform talking about drummers with amazing famous drummers in the audience compared to like working with famous stars, like as an actor? Was there a nervousness that was different to you in that, or did you not even think about that?
No, it's something else. It's a different kind of feeling. It's not nervousness. It's more like, finally. It's like, finally, I get to, you know, because I came up trying to be, you know, a successful drummer, right? So like touring and touring and touring. And it's like, my dream was always to meet these drummers and to, you know, so it's like, I never got to. And then finally, I get to do stuff with them.
Wow. Did you feel like a fanboy at those things? Do you allow yourself?
I always do. Like, I am friends with my favorite drummer ever. Can you imagine texting with your favorite drummer?
Wow. Wow.
It blows my mind. The, you know, the 14-year-old me would be shocked at being friends with, not just meeting, but being friends with a hero.
Wow. Was it a goal of yours to finally get to a point where you could do a show on drumming, or was it pretty much everyone said, yeah, Fred can do that? Or was that like something in your mind to do for a while?
It was more that like I was supposed to do a stand-up special for Netflix.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had some material and I was working on stuff. But then as a sort of side project, I've been doing a little bit of like stand-up for drummers. Not a full show, but just like would talk about, hey, this is just for drummers. And then as I was coming up with the Netflix one, the drumming stuff is the only material that had like a sort of like drive. There was a drive to it. I was like, the material came quickly and without effort, without question. The only question was, is there enough of an audience to understand these very specific jokes?
Right, right.
I explained it to this guy, Robbie Prah at Netflix. And he took the gamble. He was like, go for it. Just try it. Let's see what this is like. At least there, you know, it's a good solid hour of material. So it was a little bit of a gamble. And then it worked out. Because I think as time goes, people who have a specific interest can find something just for them. So it kind of, it makes sense now.
Yeah. And I think they were pretty smart with the filming, I would say, too. I'm not really good at watching editing, but sometimes I notice that, like, even when you're doing in-jokes for drummers, if you give a little bit of, you know, look over at the audience and seeing them appreciating it or understanding or even questioning it, it gives that audience who don't know that world like a little bit of insight into what
yes.
you're talking about, and adds a whole nother level of interest for them for something they don't know about. So I thought there was whoever handled that, I thought did a really good job with that.
That's Lance Bangs. Lance Bangs has worked on some great stuff, and he's a friend of mine as well.
My other question, I was fascinated watching you during that, is I think as an actor myself too, that I am one of those where if I put on the costume, there's a whole nother level of understanding that's almost instinctual to the character that I might not have known in rehearsals when I didn't have costumes. So
yeah.
I try to get like Nicolas Cage. He always has to have a hat in a movie, you know, because it connects him to it. I had wondered if there's a little bit of feeling like that in going behind those drum sets. Like, I thought there was really interesting of you of taking on those styles. Like, would you say all of those different styles you did behind those drums were styles you learned, or is there something added once you're sitting behind?
It kind of goes the other way around. It's kind of more like, what can I do? So I think, what do I know about every decade of drumming? It's limited. It's limited, right? Because I don't know certain styles of music well enough. I don't know enough, for example, about the history of reggae drumming. I love dub music and I love those drummers, but I don't know how to play it well enough to go into. So there are areas that I'm like, well, before I start doing, I only pick what I know. So that's where I start. So I go, what do I know from the 20s? They do those kind of silent movie effects. What do I know from the 30s? I don't know, kind of like that swishy sound. So it's more like, first I pick what I know, then I line up the drum kit, and that's when I can. So it seems like I'm going through it with ease, but it's like what I already know. So it's almost like the equivalent of like taking people through words you already know, and it seems like, wow, you know. But there's a lot of music that I don't, you know. I love Latin music, right? I love salsa, I love samba, I love, you know, Latin rhythms. I don't play them well enough to have gone through Latin percussion all the way through kit to kit. So I just don't do it.
But you give the appearance of having all of the knowledge of all of
Alice. You know, which is fine. I mean, it's
well
just
played,
like,
Fred.
It's more like I should have prefaced the whole thing by saying, like, this is what I know of 30s music, 50. But it's just basically rock and roll, and like, it's basically rock and roll, really, with like a little bit of jazz from the 30s.
Yeah. Did you ever, here's a weird question you probably couldn't answer. Maybe I'll have to go to an expert on the selling of drums. But what do you think happened with those electronic drums? Why didn't they? I know you have a soft spot in your heart for those, and I do too. Thinking of like,
oh,
a
do
lot
you mean
of them,
like whatever happened to Simmons drums?
Yeah. Yeah.
They became like everything, like an iPod classic.
Yeah.
Bigger and more cumbersome than we'd imagined. So Simmons drums are pretty, actually kind of thick and kind of big, and it's just a pad. So other companies came along and were able to go like, actually we can make it more, you know, easier to play with a mesh head. We can make them smaller. We can make them more manageable, and we can make more a variety of sounds. Simmons had a pretty, now I love Simmons, but after a while you just have to, which I hate, but you have to keep reinventing your own invention so that people can, you know, otherwise Roland came along and was like, we've got these Roland drums. I mean, they just have so many variations and they're so light, and there's like a library of sounds. So it's just evolution of those things.
Also reminds me of I remember going through the period in the 80s or early 90s when it was between VCR and Beta, and you had different like video stores that were backing Beta and VCR. And there's like economists that talk about the sort of the chaos theory involved in that. Like,
yeah,
it was an unpredictable thing that eventually led to VCRs being more promoted and then made better and better, even though Beta out of the gate was supposed to be like better. I don't know.
Yeah. And it was smaller.
Yeah.
But who knows? I mean, it's like, it is a chaotic thing, but it's like the same, you know, for whatever reason that in England and Ireland, they drive on the left or whatever on the right, you know, like that whole, like, who knows? Like, who knows? People just choose things, you know, and it's just something takes it or something doesn't. And, you know, I'm sure Simmons could have had an opportunity to keep evolving. Who knows?
Yeah. When I saw those drums, I don't even know if they use them, but it reminds me of a band that I had that passion for, is the like Thompson Twins, who were all into those mechanical drums and instruments.
Yeah.
I love that band. Still to this day, I'll listen.
They're great.
Yeah.
You know, I saw them recently, maybe 2018, 2019, and they had so many hits. I was like, that's a hit. Where you remember for some reason, because of MTV, you have an image of just hearing like one or two songs, but no, they kept going. And
they have Wish You Were Here, which is in Candle, 16 Candles.
Something like that. Yeah.
And that doesn't sound anything like them. And I remember going, wow, that's right. That's Thompson Twins too.
Yeah. And what's weird too is that like, so at the time I remember we thought it was so digital and so computerized, and now it's so analog. It just sounds like, because I think people are actually hitting pads or hitting drums. It's just like, it's not as sequenced as I remember.
I ask a lot of comedians this, coming from and knowing a lot of people that make a living into that, is that you're passionate about these, especially about the drummer one, you're passionate about these things, and yet you're able to make fun of them. That's, being a comedian myself too, I have a hard time doing that. I am not a very good satirist, or I was talking to Perry Grip the other day from Nerf Herder, I talked about that ability to mock culture or something. And I just, do you have anything to say, Fred, of that being an artist who balances on that loving something, but also being able to make fun of it, and like what that does to like an internal, the internal workings of a person? Cause you become pretty well known for that. I mean, in many ways.
But I'm not even thinking of it as making fun of it. It's almost like I'm celebrating it. I'm repeating it. I'm like having fun with it. I try, my tone isn't like, isn't this dumb? Although that's probably fine too, but
dumb
it's
is
like,
okay too.
But it's almost like, I always think of it as like an impression. That's all it is. It's like, if someone does an impression, you could see it as making fun of them, but it's also just celebrating them too. So for me, it's, you know, it's about celebrating all those style drumming things, or like, or isn't this annoying when this happens? If you, you know, drop a wing nut on your cymbal stand, that kind of thing.
I can't remember who it was. I asked some writer of comedy if they ever felt like they just took one too far, where it was just plain making fun of something and they felt bad. Have you had anything like that? Like in Saturday Night Live or in Portlandia or just any kind of situation?
What's weird is it's less that like the reason I would feel bad is that something would be seen as making fun of. So it's more that I'm like, you know, I'm like, no, that's not what I meant. I meant that, you know, I meant that I love this thing. Like in the stand-up special, I say that I don't like jazz, which is not true. I love jazz. I love it. But it's almost like a comedian would make fun of, I don't like tapas, food from Spain or something, you know, like it's, you're just kind of messing around. So, but it's not that I would feel bad. It's more that I'm like, you know, hey, I'm just trying to have fun with something.
I thought some of the stuff they allowed in that Netflix series was some looks to drummers that were like, yeah, that's not what it's like.
Because it should be like a discussion, not a political rally. You know?
Yeah, I thought that was pretty great. It was also cool to see Trey on there. I think I sent you a text once that we have a famous show that Larry from Lookout Records did. When we drove out there, we played with Mr. T Experience, Green Day when they first started. And Trey was actually in Larry's band, The Lookouts, at that time. And we played up at that mountain, the top of the, I call it Lookout Mountain. But we played down the street from Jerry Garcia. So no one showed up to the show. But Jerry kicked out some like people that were too much on LSD, even for Jerry Garcia.
Wow.
And sent them to our show. So there's this famous show that no one was at, with you know, Mr. T Experience,
wow,
Preaching Weasel, Green Day, you know, right before Trey was in the band, you know, and he got asked, I think, right after that, and there was no one there but these, like, I remember them, these drugged out hippies that were more fucking weird than we could have ever been, like, dancing in this non-pit. So I just wanted to share that story with you because
that's so cool.
It's one of those memories that I just actually had Larry on the show and we talked about that crazy experience.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing. I love that things happen that way and you don't even realize it at the time.
My sister said she worked at the Middle Eastern Cafe in Boston for a while, and I think you had a drumming act that you would tour for, that like a band, comedian band. She said she saw you play there before.
She's right, but it's an early version of, like, that's an early thing. What did I do?
I tell you, she's been a fan for a long time, so she's,
that's really, really nice.
That's one of the reasons I got you on.
Oh, that's so nice. It wasn't like the drumming special, but there was like when I was starting to do live stuff with comedy. Yeah. God, what did I do? It was early days of doing that kind of thing.
Yeah, I thought she said it was like a South American influenced drum beat thing. I'm getting her wrong. She knows exactly what it was, but
it might have been,
I'm getting it wrong.
As part of my act, I might have done Fericito, like this Venezuelan tamale.
Yeah, I think she had mentioned that.
So that might have been part of it. But yeah, those early days of me doing like performance comedy.
When I don't even know if this can be answered, Fred, but when did you go from like, my God, I'm a really good musician, which I think you are, from I've learned, but my God, I'm a performer. I'm a like a actor, comedian, performer. Was that a slow transition, or did you have like
a fast moment? It was in like 98. I did this that South by Southwest video where I was like interviewing bands and stuff.
I will have a link on the webpage. The video is on YouTube, and it's listed as Fred Armisen's Guide to Music and South by Southwest, 1998.
I think around then, the reaction to the video of me interviewing bands, and this is VHS days, was more instant than with Trench Mouth, right? And so somewhere, because I remember, you know, Lounge Acts in Chicago, I showed the video at Lounge Acts, and people really turned out for it, to show a video. And right then, all of a sudden, I was like, I think, you know, I could feel it. I was like, if I do comedy, something happens. Whereas when I was playing drums, stuff happened kind of, but it wasn't with the same intensity.
It sounds like an almost an insult, but it isn't. Do you feel like you keyed into a comedy that was a little bit more, not conventional, but more, I don't know, acceptable than your music was?
Definitely. You know, my relationship with music is like, I love it. I love drumming. I will always love drum. I will consider myself a drummer. But like my relationship with music, I don't know that it was like, it's nice of you to say that I'm a good musician, right? I think I'm okay. Like, I think I could do some cool stuff, but I'm not like, you remember Tortoise, right? John McIntyre, John Herndon.
The band Fred just mentioned is Tortoise. Tortoise is almost entirely instrumental music and defies easy categorization. The group gained significant attention from their early career. The members have roots in Chicago's fertile music scene, playing in various indie rock and punk groups. Tortoise was among the first American indie rock bands to incorporate styles closer to krautrock, dub, minimalism, electronica, and various jazz styles, rather than the standard rock and roll and punk that had dominated indie rock for years. That's from Discogs. Also, Fred just mentioned two of the drummers, John McIntyre and John Herndon. Back to Fred.
I remember the way that they approach music, the way they approach drumming, how your drums are recorded. That's what is like a reminder to me that I'm like, maybe I wasn't meant to be one of those drummers, because they have an ear for it. I don't know how to tune a drum. I tune them up as high as they go, and that's fine with me. So when Trench Mouth would record, the rest of the band would stay for the mixing, right? With the engineer and like just getting the mix right. I couldn't get out of there fast enough. I was like, I don't care. I don't know. Sounds fine. Well, make the drums loud. I don't know. As long as that snare drum's in there. And I think people who are truly brilliant at drumming and, you know, who have that thing, they stay and they practice and they know how to tune a drum. I mean this with, you know, respect to myself. I'm so happy to be a drummer, but I'm not one of those guys. So comedy comes to me so much easier, where I do want to spend time on it, where I do want to like think of what a joke is and what works and what doesn't, where I do want to be in the editing room. Music, my relationship, I'm so happy to be in it, but I am, as life has turned out, I'm just like, I'm not one of those people who like can even discern the difference between a mix. I'm like, I don't know. I hear the bass, sounds great. You know?
Wow.
So that's all. It's like a career change that made sense. I was like, clearly I'm not John, because I imagine John Herndon and John McIntyre to be like, that to me, like those are the real, you know, like the way they approach drums. I'm like, I'm not one of those guys, and they should do that. And maybe I should start doing comedy.
Wow. Do you think that goes for all, I mean, you play all different instruments. Do you think, Perry Grip admitted to me that I was picking at him and picking at him. He admitted that part of he tries to be a collective, but he says part of him wants that love of an audience because he feels not loved. I was wondering whether maybe being a drummer didn't give you that.
It didn't.
Yeah.
But the happy ending is then after all of that, right? Let's say I, you know, gave up being in a band. Oddly, I ended up being in front of an audience playing drums, doing comedy. It worked itself out. So
yeah.
My dream of being Green Day, it didn't go that way. But all of a sudden, you know, the special that you saw was like, there I was doing comedy with the kid. So it oddly worked out anyway.
I just had an interview with Victor from Violent Femmes, one of my favorite bands of all time. And he's doing a lot of interesting stuff that doesn't get much play. But he talked about, I just forgot what we were talking about. Oh, damn. I didn't just want to bring his name up, the name drop. But
well, you were talking about getting the love from audiences from playing the drums.
I felt stupid that I was trying to remember a story and forgotten the moment, but that's kind of what happens a little bit with my interview style, because I'm listening to them, but also trying to think of the next question, since I don't particularly do them in order, but just do them as they feel right in the moment. So I wrote Fred back later and said, remembered the Victor Violent Femmes thing. He was doubting his career choices. He was having dinner with Willem Dafoe and said, "I regret not continuing with theater and leaving with you to New York." And Willem said, "Victor, you started the fucking Violent Femmes." But he still holds regrets. Fred sent me the little ha-ha emoji, so that's how our conversations ended. Back to the end of the interview.
Oh, you know, there was one thing I didn't even realize. It's interesting how sometimes our fans know more about us than we do. Like, I'll often be approached by someone that asks me about something. I go, "You already know more about it than I do." And I heard that you were on one of the Underdog, which I helped. You know, Russ Forster was on the show too, who started Underdog, and I'm friends with Doug. And you were on the Octunks Vi compilation. And I was like, "Oh yeah, we weren't on that one because we actually produced the first Octung one." And then I went back and looked who was on it, and we were on it with you. So
isn't that funny when that happens? You're like, "Oh, we never played that show." I'm like, "Oh, that's right, we did play that show."
Yeah. I thought about that because Doug Ward lived in that area too. He's like one of the first punks to move to like Wicker Park and live in that area.
But I love that compilation. That's such a cool compilation. Yeah.
Are you familiar with Gage?
No, I remember Gage. Yeah.
Yes. Gub Scott Conway has been in my band, even in Black Isles, for like 17 years. He's the guy who started.
Oh, wow. Tell him hi.
Brilliant guy. Like inspired like Jazz Freddie and a lot of those Promise Rings bands that went on to be bigger. But also on there was our drummer, was in this band Ivy League that became the Screeching Weasel drummer that made the famous lineup. And so that compilation is like, "Oh, I didn't even know. Oh, there's Fred's band. There's my favorite guitarist ever, who's now one of my best friends, and our drummer that made us famous. He's in another band."
That's awesome.
Just on that compilation.
A little bit. That is a really, that's a cool compilation.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think Underdog, they were like the Underdog, basically. They didn't get a lot of credit for what they had done. And
no, but
looking back
great
at some of those comps, you're like, "Wow, those were like bands that were really taking risks in those days."
Totally, yeah. Underdog, yeah.
Let me just let them eat jelly beans. I don't have to say anything about that. We both love the compilation. That's been said already. Fred, you can go.
You did great research, and I'm glad we worked out getting to do this.
It's such a pleasure to talk to you. I love people that in the punk scene that have gone on to do amazing other things and still sort of value that the aesthetic that they learned from that. So I really respect that in you. So,
well, thank you. I really appreciate it. And it's great. I'm glad we got to talk.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Fred.
Sure. See you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Johnny's got a bubble that he's out of control.
Johnny's got a bubble that he's out of control. Thank you, everybody, for listening to this episode of Jughead's Basement. I really do appreciate you, and I appreciate you appreciating this, the thing that I do, and I love doing, and will continue doing. So please share all episodes and help out as much as you can, financially or just in your level of excitement. Upcoming will be John Personality, or John Stockfish, of Screeching Weasel and The Vindictives. Also, we'll have Kepi Ghouli, a long-form interview with the man, the legend, the artist, the musician, and almost universally agreed upon as one of the kindest, happiest people they have met. We'll see what I can get out of him. Also, I have Jessica Colombo coming up, who is the woman who fronts the podcast Mabel Syndrome. That's it. Let's make this short. Patreon, www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com. Goodbye, y'all. Miss ya already.